Welcome to Good Calls with Dean Blandino, a production of iHeartRadio. All right, welcome to another episode of Good Calls. I'm Dean Blandino. As always, I'm joined by Travis Hanson.
What's going on, man?
You're
making it weird.
Your introductions get more awkward every week. And Travis, you're like a pretty personable guy, but put a microphone in front of you, you're like, hey, what's going on?
I just don't want to step on you. I don't want to get in the way. And then you make this happen.
And our audio guy, Joe Madrid, who is slowly but surely becoming the MVP of the show. The audio is sounding crisper and crisper each week. This is a compliment. I don't give many. As these guys know, and I'm giving Joe a compliment.
You're getting a lot better, man.
Every week
I feel more and more appreciated.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, moving on. So, all right, great show. We're going to talk about a lot. NFL week 12 already. It's crazy. Thanksgiving, we've got a guest appearance by Amy Trask. Amy, who, do you know what Amy's nickname is by Raiders fans? Does either of you guys know?
I don't.
We're bringing on the Princess of Darkness.
Wow.
Like, how cool is that?
That's a cool nickname.
How cool is that?
We're going to talk about nicknames later.
We're going to talk nicknames maybe. So Amy will be joining us. But let's get into it. Let's get into a subject that, you know, I didn't think we'd be talking about, but controversy in the... And when I was at the NFL, and here's the deal, and everybody feels this way at the league office. Every game, there's 256 regular season games, and every game counts the same. Okay, but the bottom line is, whether it's officiating, whether it's broadcasting, whoever, when you have a game like Cowboys Patriots, okay, on a national audience,
99%
of the country is watching Cowboys Patriots, two of the biggest fan bases you're talking about, you want that game to go smoothly from an officiating perspective, from everything. You want that game to go smoothly, not that... The other game, and I don't want to use names of teams, but the 3-8 team versus the 2-9 team in the early window, you are okay. Not you don't want an officiating mistake ever, but you are okay if it happened in that game.
You don't have as many eyeballs.
Because you don't have as many eyeballs, and it's not going to be as controversial. So what happens, Cowboys, Patriots? What did we have today? 99.9% of the country watching the game. We have controversy involving tripping.
Imagine you got some good tweets about
tripping of all the things. And if I get one more tweet with that wasn't tripping, these refs are tripping. Like if I have one more time, all right, we get it.
It's
all right,
pretty good.
Whatever.
Though.
Yeah, the first 16 times it's good. Tripping. Okay, so you have a call early in the game in the first quarter on Tyron Smith. That's again, it's a hard game to officiate, right? But the umpire in this game calls tripping on Tyron Smith early. When you talk about coverage, you have a referee and you have an umpire in the offensive backfield. The referee is going to be on the throwing hand side or the right hand, typically the right hand side of the quarterback. The umpire opposite the referee, and they each take their side of the line of scrimmage on passing plays. Okay, and they work inside out, and in this instance. The umpire called tripping. It wasn't tripping. It was kind of a double team block. Smith had, it was almost as if just by circumstance, he turned, his leg was there, the defender, they made contact. To me, it wasn't tripping. First quarter, not that big a deal. But later in the game, fourth quarter, Cowboys are behind by four. They're driving to try to take the lead. And it's a third down play. And they complete a pass for a first down, and we get another trip, this time on Travis Frederick in the middle of the line. This one's probably a little closer, but still, to me, it's not tripping. Tripping is an intentional act. Tripping, what you want to see for a trip is more of the player lifting his leg. This was, again, Frederick turning. The legs make contact. There is certainly contact with the knee and the defender. The defender goes to the ground, so I understand in the moment, in real time, the umpire seeing that, processing it, and calling the foul, but it's not, when you look at it again, a trip is a lifting of the leg. It's an intentional act. You can have a leg whip, which is more of a strike, which you're whipping the leg. That was not the case. And I certainly didn't see him lift the leg intentionally to trip the defender, and then didn't like the call. It ends up being a pretty big call, because then now you go from first and 10 to third and 11. They don't convert. You have a big overturn.
They had just picked it up on third
and
one.
Picked it up, and then you get a fourth down play a pass to Amari Cooper that was ruled complete on the field. And to the consternation of Cowboys fans everywhere, it was overturned in replay, which, again, we don't want to bring back bad memories, but that has happened before. I've been involved in maybe
could you have, when I watched that second one, I think you could have made a maybe a light argument that there was a hold on 77. What'd you think?
You know, again, with holding again is a very subjective call. Holding, you know, maybe there's a left arm, an extension of the left arm. I'd want to see more restriction. I'd want to see something more of a grab and a restriction in that instance. I think the defender went to the ground because the legs did make contact.
Yeah.
But I didn't think it was a hold. I didn't think it was a trip. It's obviously a big call. Not, again, not the reason the Cowboys lost the game, but it has an impact. And when you see very rarely, you see tripping calls. If you have 20 tripping calls all year, that's a lot. And so to see two in one game is an outlier. And then you have one official that's looking at it. And that's where, you know, if it were me in that position, if I was head of officiating, you know, you're looking at that official, you're going to show him those two plays. You're going to get that official's perspective. Okay, what did he see to make him think that was a trip? And you kind of work it that way. And then you make sure you share that with the rest of your staff to say either this is or this isn't tripping. And we don't want this call going forward, or we do want this call going forward. And again, it's an interesting call. And then there was, you know, there was an interesting situation at the end of the game with the Patriots are trying to run out the clock, and there was 5 seconds on the clock. Brady drops back. It's a fourth down play. So this is something that is coached, and you talk to teams about this, where the quarterback can just drop back, throw the ball out of bounds, and try to take as much time off the clock as necessary. And it's not grounding if the quarterback isn't under pressure, even though he throws it from the pocket, and the ball, you know, goes out of bounds. It's really just kind of an airmail type throw. But it did look like, and this would have been, it would have been more eyebrow raising had this game been in Dallas. It felt like that last second kind of just hung on a little bit.
Yeah.
It felt like it was, and when you talk about the ball, you know, when is the play over, right? The ball crossing the sideline or the ball touching something, you really look for a signal. The clock operator is looking for a signal from the official or clear indicator that the play is over. The ball really touching something out of bounds is the indicator that they use. And it felt like clock should have expired. And so Dallas did end up getting one play. It was inconsequential. They didn't do anything on that. So interesting tripping.
Yeah, those tripping calls to me, I didn't really like them either. Like the first one with Tyron Smith is he's getting hit, and it almost looks like he's trying to brace himself. He's had lower body injuries, ankles, knees, and it looks like he's just trying to get out of the way to like keep from getting stepped on or hit. And then the second one, it seemed like Travis Frederick, he took the hit on with his shoulder first, and the initial contact came there. You'd think if the initial contact comes with the leg for the trip, that's where the call would come.
You want to see an overt act. You really do. You want to see a clear lifting of the leg that's gonna impede the defender. And I just didn't think, again, these are judgment calls. And
listen, and Cowboys fan, Dean's on your side.
I'm on your side.
I think the big question is there a hashtag yet? Don't trip? Hashtag don't trip?
Tripgate? I don't
trip
know.
Tripgate?
I don't know. Maybe.
Refs be tripping.
Moving on, putting it to bed, the league did announce fines for Pittsburgh, Cleveland, and significant fines just in terms of total number, because you had so many players, Travis. I think, what was it?
33 players?
33 players. There's a number. There's a fine for fighting, for being in the fight area. So 33 players. Mason Rudolph was the winner in terms of numbers. He got 50 grand. And obviously, look, and one of the things, look, let's talk about it a little bit, is that now it came out that in his appeal, Myles Garrett had said that Mason Rudolph used obviously a racial slur, and that's what led him to hitting Rudolph with the helmet. And there are so many things, we used to talk to our officials all the time. There are so many things that are said on the field, and, you know, the league wanted to put in, I remember years ago, they wanted to curb the use of, you know, the racial slurs, or if there's anything involving sexual orientation, things like that. And it became very difficult for the officials to differentiate between what was said, you know, what is said between two players that is
or who's saying it. Who's you're saying in a pile. It,
it's a pile. Is it kind of the normal trash talk that goes on that we all know happens in every sport? Or when does it cross that line from normal trash talk to something that is truly, truly unsportsmanlike and uncalled for? And I think that's something I would show the league in their kind of investigation, for lack of a better term, you know, I was looking for audio, talking to anyone that would include the officials. I was involved in situations where an official was accused of saying something to a player, and you had to interview players and talk about who was in the area and did anybody hear anything. So it's just, it's a tough, tough deal to try to prove or disprove something mm-hmm. that's said on the football field. And so again, hopefully this thing goes away and, you know, the fines are out. Garrett's suspension was upheld. Pouncey's suspension was reduced from 3 games to 2 games, and we'll kind of see if there's any further fallout. Let's move on to our favorite subject, pass interference review. And Travis, you had a couple of things. There were a couple of comments going into the week from some head coaches, Vic Fangio from the Broncos and Sean Payton of the Saints. What did Vic have to say?
Yeah, on the 18th, last Monday, he said, "It's going to have to be a 5-car pileup, I guess, for them to overturn something."
Yeah. So, you know, and Vic, and he's referring, you know, there were two plays at the end of their game against the Vikings. There was a play at the end of the game where it looked like there might have been fouls on both players, pass interference on the offense, a push off, and then a grab by the defender, which would have led to, if they were both called, would have led to offsetting penalties and replaying the down. Denver was obviously trying to come back and get a score at the end of the game. There was a play, two plays earlier, where the defender clearly grabbed the Broncos receiver's face mask with the ball in the air. The game was not stopped. It was under 2 minutes. The game was not stopped. There was no foul added in replay. So I understand Vic's frustration. But we're going to talk about how from last week to this week, it may have gone from a 5-car pileup to a little bit of a fender bender in terms of the standard. But Sean Payton had some very interesting comments to talk about the process of PI review.
He said this on Friday. He said, "I think it's a challenge for Al Riveron. It's a challenge for New York when we go to New York. And quite honestly, I think the numbers looking at those plays from a consistency standpoint need to be, it's hard to be singular in that position. It's hard for one person," Payton said. He said, "Thursday night when coaches meet," he's talking about his team, "on a phase of a game, you know there's going to be 4 or 5 voices that can have thoughts and opinions on the decision, not one person. And I think Al does a great job. And yet I think the number needs to be more like 3 or 5.
It's an interesting thought and concept. So when replay went to, when I was at the NFL, 2014 was the first year we were involved in replay decisions. And the theory was, okay, you have 17 different officiating crews and you have 17 different replay officials. Mm-hmm. And they may look at the same play a little bit differently. And we would see it every week because we'd be in the command center. We would see a call overturned in Seattle with less evidence than a call not overturned in Baltimore with more evidence. So you were trying to create a process that was consistent in terms of decision-making. So you bring in less people mm-hmm. and you say, okay, there's going to be a small group of people in New York that are going to make these decisions or be involved at that time, be involved with the referee in these decisions. In theory, you're going to create greater consistency by reducing the number of people making the decisions. I think what Sean is saying is it's a tremendous burden on one person, and it is. It really is. And you're talking about one person having to look at all of these plays and try to adjudicate these plays consistently, and it's hard. And so I would agree that maybe it is 2 to 3 people that are trained, that are taught, that understand what the framework is and understand what the standards are and can make those decisions. Because I know I was in that role, and that's a very difficult job. And Al is doing the best job he can. He's doing a good job, but there's so much on his plate. There's so much on his plate, and it's hard to do all of those things because you always feel like in that role, like you're putting out another fire, mm-hmm. right? You're dealing with another controversy. You're dealing with, and I can't imagine Al having to deal with pass interference review and all of the scrutiny and everything else. But guess what? There's 18 billion other things that he's got to deal with. And it's really hard. And I think Sean might be onto something
Well, I know three guys at this table right here that might be great at it, right?
Oh, yeah. You guys.
I'm looking for a job.
You guys are really good. But let's move to what happened on Sunday, where I really feel like the standard has changed, at least from a perspective of the call that's not made on the field. Because going into the week, we had 71 reviews, 12 reversals, right? So doing the math, carry the one, 16.9%, okay? 16.9% of the reviews are being overturned. On Sunday, there were unofficially 6 reviews for pass interference and 3 were overturned. So let me do the math. That's 50%. Okay. That's 50%. That's a much bigger number. And we saw 3 calls get overturned. We saw a touchdown get taken back in the Jets Raiders game on an OPI that was added in replay. And what's significant about that is it was ruled a touchdown. So it had to be initiated by the booth. And we've seen non-calls in automatic review situations not stopped for what was probably just as much contact or maybe even more contact than that play. And it was, and I think it is offensive pass interference by the letter of the rule, but it's not to the standard of what we've established going into the week. Then you had another call that was added in the Dolphins Browns game. Again, stopped inside of 2 minutes. And so you have a replay official. This isn't a coach challenging where they're forced to look at it. This is the replay official deciding in New York deciding to stop it. And it was pass interference. And it was, I think it was Odell Beckham that got in, that got contacted. And that was overturned and added pass interference. And if you compare that play to Golden Tate play, Giants Patriots, if you compare that to even earlier in the year, there was a play involving Richard Sherman and Mike Evans. There was blocking downfield with Sammy Watkins. If you compare those plays that weren't overturned to this one, I think anyone looking at it would say those are fouls. This one is questionable. And then you had a could have been a really big call in the Carolina-New Orleans game where not called on the field, challenged by the Panthers, and created in replay for pass interference. And it is pass interference, but again, is it up to that standard? So I think we've seen a shift. And
why do you think that was? I know
there was a call this week between the competition committee. I don't know who, but at least one member of the competition committee and the officiating group in New York, there was a call and the main topic was pass interference review. And so putting two and two together, knowing there was a call and just seeing the result of the reviews on Sunday, to me, that tells me that the needle has moved, at least when it comes to the call not made on the field. And this is the concern. And I think when it's been a moving target all year and it mm-hmm. feels like it's moved again. And, right. and I'm not saying this is not necessarily the wrong direction, right? But again, it's hard when you're moving it from week to week or from quarter of the season to quarter of the season, it's hard for clubs to get a handle on it.
Is this similar to what we saw earlier in the season when they had that conference call and teams weren't alerted of this, that there was going to be
that
a change?
That was offensive holding. You know, right. We saw that early in the season. And I think, you know, in all of this, and I know Coach Payton, I think Sean said something after the game, and I think he had some comments about, it definitely is related to the pass interference call that was.
Yeah, he said it wasn't our best game. It wasn't their best game. And quite honestly, it wasn't New York's best game.
When they change, like, how they're going to rule, do they let the coaches know, hey, we're going to tighten up or we're going to loosen up a little bit on that stuff?
They should. And that's the thing. If you know, when I was at the league office and before that, you know, Pereira and Carl Johnson before me, you would put out videos. And so if there was something significant, a point of emphasis, you know, I would do a tape that would go out to the clubs every Thursday and it would highlight things. Here's typically it would be anything from the previous week that needed explanation and or something that might have been controversial or something that was rules related that I felt the clubs could benefit from. And then it was something, if we were going to emphasize something or we were going to, and you don't have changes very often, but if something was going to change, you would put it on that tape and make sure the clubs understood that here's, we were doing this, we're going to be doing something a little bit different. And so you would hope that the clubs are notified of that. And again, because these are challenges that are tied to timeouts, and they're limited, and they're important. And
so do we know stats on how many were challenged? Because I would think if they knew that it was gonna, they were going to loosen up on it, then there would be more challenged.
Well, there wasn't. So when you look at the number of challenges, I have to go back and look this week. I don't think there were significantly more challenges this week than in previous weeks. We just know that there were three overturns this week, which is a high number. I think that might be... I don't think we've had more than three and during any other week.
Yeah.
And so
I don't feel like there were a lot more.
I'd be willing to bet next week it's going to go up quite
again,
a bit.
Yeah, I would agree.
That's the key. If once you see that, and if there is any communication with the clubs, then now as a club, I'm going to say, hey, we're going to challenge more because we have a better chance at winning these.
BA is going to be throwing that red flag.
Arians is just going to be like flinging it.
Do you think you're seeing this now because these games are a little bit more significant now as you get into the later part of the season, the last quarter of the season?
Yeah, it's a variety of things. Could be, you know, you obviously, look, it's not ideal to have calls in the middle of the season and change things. And I'm not saying it never happens, but it's just not ideal because to say that the teams were playing under a standard in week 3 that was different than the standard in week 12, that's tough. If I'm a team right. and a call that didn't get overturned in week 3 would have gotten overturned in this new standard and that impacted my game, I'm going to be pissed.
Yeah.
So I have a question. Somebody texted me, cuz when you know Dean, you become Dean. So everybody who has a rule of football question, they text me and then I have to ask him.
Yeah,
I thought this was a really good one
to them. Yeah.
So if coaches are out of challenge, why don't they take the red flag away from them so they don't get the penalty?
There should be someone on the team that takes it away.
So they
right?
do. So when that's a good question. So the coach, when the coach is either out of challenges or at the 2-minute warning, the officials will go over to the coach and say, "Coach, you can't challenge anymore. You got to put the red flag away." So the official doesn't take the red flag from them, but the officials tell them, "You're out of challenges, or it's 2-minute warning. You can't challenge. You got to put the challenge flag away." And so every coach knows after the 2-minute warning they can't throw the red flag. So if they do, they're doing it for a reason. There are some unusual situations. We had one a couple of weeks ago with the Rams where it was an interception that was overturned because of a penalty.
Yeah.
That's a new rule, a little bit unusual. Coach McVay threw the flag. I get that. But every coach knows once we get to 2-minute warning, and the officials go and tell them. They don't take the red flag.
There should be like a get back coach. He should take the flag.
Somebody has it.
Yeah, if there's any of you head coaches out there, if you need a flag taker.
Joe's good at taking things and losing them.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, exactly. Wow. Don't give him the red flag because he might lose
it. Well,
he'd
lose it.
Like he lost my ATM card a couple of weeks ago that I just got a new one back and had to do, you know.
Moving right along.
A couple of places that had like automatic payment coming out. So if my lights go off, we'll know why.
Thanks a lot, Sean.
Got it, buddy.
You know, I've got a good story about the league meeting.
Let's save it. We should probably go to break.
Can we get that story after the break?
No, after the break, we're going to talk to the Princess of Darkness,
such a great
Amy
name.
Trask. Maybe later we'll talk about that league meeting story. Amy Trask next on Good Calls. All right, we're back on Good Calls. I am so excited to introduce our guest this week. She is a football analyst for CBS Sports, an author, You Negotiate Like a Girl, chairman of the board for Big Three Basketball, former CEO of the Oakland Raiders, the Princess of Darkness herself, Amy Trask. Amy, thank you so much for joining me. And I want to ask you a question. You are known as the Princess of Darkness amongst Raider fans, which I think is the coolest nickname. How did you get that nickname?
Well, thanks for inviting me to join you. I'm thrilled to do so. And it is the coolest nickname ever. And it was not intended as a compliment. Mike Silver, who at the time was with Sports Illustrated, wrote a feature. And in it, he quoted some anonymous sources within the NFL. I don't remember whether they were team owners or team executives or a combination. But they said in a not complimentary manner that behind my back, they referred to me as the Princess of Darkness. Well, what wasn't intended as a compliment, I accepted and embraced as a compliment, as did Raider Nation. We all thought it was terrific, and we claimed it. So since then, I've been the Princess of Darkness, and I hope right now that you're just a little bit afraid, Dean.
I'm always a little bit, maybe not afraid, but intimidated and in awe of what you've accomplished. And I love the fact, and what better, I mean, it's the Raiders. How great is Princess of Darkness Raiders? To me, it's awesome. And
I agree.
So you grew up in LA, you were a Raiders fan. And then when they came back to LA, kind of was in line, you were at law school, you interned in the legal department, then went back and you were the CEO in 1997 until you retired in 2013. And you've done so many things. I mean, I just saw, you know, in 2019, you were named one of the 100 greatest game changers in NFL history. And I want to talk a little bit about that experience, you know, being in a male dominated industry like football. And I read your book and I want to talk a little bit about your experiences with the Raiders. What was that like just breaking in and how did you manage that?
Well, you noted it. I grew up in Los Angeles, but I did my college up in Northern California. I was at Berkeley and fell in love with everything about the Raider organization when I was just up the freeway, so to speak, up the road at Cal. That was when the Raiders were there. And when I came down to Los Angeles for grad school, when I returned home to Los Angeles for grad school, is when the team relocated. And I thought, wow, isn't that my great fortune? My team's coming with me. And I know that did not resonate well when the team left. I wasn't with the organization when Al moved it from Oakland to Los Angeles. But when I was in grad school down here, picked up the phone, called the organization and asked about doing an internship. And what attracted me to the organization, I loved football from the time I was a kid. What attracted me to the Raiders in particular was everything about the organization resonated with me. Al would hire people that other organizations would label behavior problems. And having been labeled a behavior problem when I was in kindergarten, that struck a chord with me. And Al gave people second and third and fourth chances. And I was given a lot of chances. And it just everything about the organization. And you touched upon gender. You know, there will be people listening to your terrific podcast who liked the Raiders and liked Al Davis, and people who hated the Raiders or still hate them and hated Al Davis. But if everyone's being intellectually honest about it, he deserves so much credit for hiring without regard to race, gender, ethnicity, or any other individuality, which has no bearing on whether someone can do a job.
And I thought I worked with Art Schell when Art was at the league office, and he spoke so highly of Al Davis. I never had the opportunity to meet Al. I've met Mark on numerous occasions and had conversations with him, but I know Art spoke so highly of Al Davis, and you talk about that, you know, giving people a chance and that what was it like to work for Al?
It was the opportunity of a lifetime. And, you know, of course, Al hired Tom Flores, and I'm listing this only chronologically. He hired Tom, and then he hired me in the mid-80s. And the reason I note that is, think about that, Dean.
Yeah.
We're talking now in the mid-2000, you know, 2017, 2019, and we started talking about it, I don't know, 2015, maybe a little earlier, maybe a little later, the mid part of this block of time. About women in sports, but in the mid-80s, like 1984, we weren't talking about that. And then he hired Art Schell, and without, and I say this with a big smile on my face, not only did he hire without regard to race, gender, ethnicity, he fired without regard to those things, and he cussed at people without regard to those individualities, which, as I said, have no bearing on whether we can do a job. The biggest misconception about Al, and this goes to the heart of your question about working for him, the biggest misconception is that he wouldn't tolerate anyone who disagreed with him.
Mm-hmm.
Because if that were the case, I would have been fired about 2 weeks into my job.
No, you're not disagreeable. Never.
I disagree agreeably. But I do disagree when I wish to disagree. And I did. 2 weeks into my job, I disagreed with him. And we had a loud, loud discussion. He yelled, I yelled, we yelled. I don't have a dainty voice under the best of circumstances. And, you know, after we'd been going at one another for, you know, I don't know, quite a while, he looked at me and he said, oh, I gotcha. I got it. And we moved right on. He understood the point I was making. And what I learned right then, 2 weeks into my job, of course you can disagree with him, but if you're going to do so, you better come armed with data and information and facts, because if you're going to disagree, he's going to have a disagreement. And you better just know what you're talking about.
Yeah. I like I said, so many people talk so highly of Al Davis, and I've just missed him when I was at the league office. It just, we didn't, you know, I just didn't get a chance to meet him, but right. I wish I really would have had an opportunity. Now, I read your book, You Negotiate Like a Girl, and one of the excerpts that I really like was when you ran into a good friend of mine, Andrea Kramer, in the bathroom at the league meeting. And I never really thought about this, because I've been to a ton of league meetings like you have, and I always think about like the lines for the men's room compared to the lines for the ladies' room. In most instances, it's the ladies' room has the long line. Well, at the league meeting, it's all men. And
no
you
line.
Talk, right? No line. It's, and you talk about like two of the most powerful people, not women, people in sports in the ladies' room. And you talked about like just being intimidated by Andrea. And if anybody that has ever seen Andrea is not, she's a tiny person, but physically, but everything else about her is so amazingly just tremendous. And I just thought that was, you know, what was that like just being in those meetings at that time and being one of very few women, you know, what resistance did you experience from any group?
Well, when I started attending league meetings in the mid 80s, there were no other women in the room. Oh, I'm sorry, that weren't related to ownership. Oh, actually, you know, there's the one big league meeting a year where families come.
Yeah.
But the two per club meetings and the one per club meetings, the discussion of women in sports wasn't happening. When I went to my first league meeting, you know how it works, Dean, the owners and executives gather in the back of the room and,
sure.
and have a little bit of coffee or whatever before the meeting starts. And I was in the back of the room and someone turned and looked at me, the owner of another team, and asked me to get him coffee. And I quickly realized I'm the only woman in this room who's not part of the catering staff. So I had a lot of fun with it. I reacted in a manner that worked well for me.
Yeah.
I've been criticized by others who told me I should have gotten annoyed or I should have given them a lecture. And I handled it in a way that I thought was going to be very effective, and it was. And I thought it was going to be very fun, and it was. I looked at him and I said, sure, how do you take that? And he told me, and I handed him his coffee, and I knew when that meeting started in a few minutes and the two people per club took a seat and he saw I was there, he would put two and two together.
Yeah.
and remember the coffee incident. Well, I got him his coffee, and a few minutes later we went in and Al and I sat in our two seats, and he looked over and saw me. You could actually almost see the blood draining from his face. And I started laughing and he started laughing. And from that moment on, he could not have been more supportive and more encouraging of me than he was. But I did regularly remind him, he never even tipped me for the coffee.
Yeah, exactly. What was that about?
Right. But, you know, I had the just magnificent privilege and pleasure of working with just terrific human beings who interacted with me without regard to gender. And that's how I approached my job. I never spent a moment thinking about the fact that I was a woman. It strikes me as counterintuitive if one doesn't want others thinking about one's gender for one to spend time thinking about one's gender. I mean, if I want to walk into a meeting and I don't want anyone else thinking about the fact that I'm a woman, then I don't think I should be thinking about the fact that I'm a woman.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting, you know, talk about like that gender blind concept, and you want to treat people the same regardless of gender. And I went through a similar situation, not me personally, but I hired Sarah Thomas, who was the first female NFL official.
You sure did.
And Sarah was the same way. Sarah, I want to be a game official. I don't want to be a female game official. I want to be a game official, and I'm going to treat you the same way, and I expect to be treated the same way as any other game official. And as you know, when you realize you're a game official, people don't treat you that well. And so, you know, for Sarah, I remember it was Bruce Arians who kind of baptized her into the NFL, and Bruce will MF anyone, and he MF Sarah during a preseason game, and we talked about it after the game. And I said, you made it. You're an NFL official now, because regardless of gender, you're going to get that type of treatment. And I think, you know, that was a very similar experience for her. And I, you know, it's just so hard nowadays to be that, you know, to be blind to that, because we hear like you said, you were there in the 80s. We're still talking about every time we have a female coach, or it's a story. When do you think it becomes a non-story?
You know what? What a brilliant point you make, and I'm glad you made it, because as exciting as these things are, and I want to touch on your hiring of Sarah for a moment, but as exciting as these things are, what's going to be truly exciting is when this is no longer a story, mm-hmm. when it's no longer a story, when someone is hired who isn't typically hired in a role, whether it's due to gender or race or any other, you know, individuality that has been excluded in the past. So, you know, that's when it's going to be exciting, when we no longer are talking about these things because it becomes the norm. But I remember when you hired Sarah, hats off to you, because you did it because she was the right person for the job. You didn't do it for any other reason. Mm-hmm. And I was interviewed about that quite a bit. And my point was exactly the one you just made. You know what? She'll do her job. And guess what? She's going to get booed, and she's going to get cussed at, and she's going to get cussed out. And you know what? If you do it to a male official, you should do it to a female official. And that was my instinct, my gut impression of what Sarah wanted. And it turns out that is how she viewed her job as well. I will tell you that one of the most special moments in my career was when we were with a group of people. And I'll try to make this very short, but essentially he was apologizing to a different woman in the room, a visitor we had, saying in advance, look, you know, I'll try not to swear. I don't like to swear in front of women. And I looked over at him like, what did you just say? And he didn't see me looking at him. And then he said, and I would never swear at a woman. And my pen flew out of my hand and landed on the desk with a thump, because the man swore at me all the time.
Probably every day. Yeah.
Multiple times. Yeah. And he looked over at me and realized what he had said and how I reacted. And he said, oh, Amy, I swear at Amy, but I don't consider her a woman. And that was the biggest compliment he could ever have given me.
Yeah.
That he evaluated me without regard to gender.
Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, my motives were questioned when we hired Sarah, and the league's motives were questioned. Are we just hiring her because she's a female? Is it a PR thing? And it was tough. It was tough because the league wanted to celebrate her making, you know, that milestone. But we also, and I had many conversations with her, we also wanted to protect her and say, look, she's just another game official. And I think your point is a great one too. When it will be really exciting is when it's not a story. And hopefully that's coming in the near term versus, you know, farther down the line.
And of course it's not exactly. And of course it's not mutually exclusive to both recognize that she got her job on the merits without regard to gender, but that by you hiring her, that's a heck of a message to little girls that they too can pursue their dreams and know that there are people who will hire them without regard to gender. Now, listen, I want your listeners to know that when you and I interacted when we were both in the league, there was never, in my view, in my estimation, in my experience, any time you interacted with me in any manner other than you would have had I been a male.
Sure. Yeah.
Does that, you know, and that, by the way, that's how it should be. Whether we were on the same side of an issue or wanting to strangle one another, gender should not, not that I would ever want to do that to an official or anyone in the officiating department, I should say. But my experience with the officials in the league during my years, with you, with Mike Pereira, gender was never an issue.
And that's how we approached it as well. I do want to, I would be remiss. We talked about officiating. So let's shift gears a little bit. I would be remiss if I didn't bring up the play. And I know this is something that, you know, I know it haunts you and you probably still wake up at night and you see Walt Coleman's face. The Tuck play. Okay. Talk to me about what your experience, what was happening, what was going through your mind as it all unfolded on that snowy evening up in Foxborough.
Well, as you know, it was Foxborough, as you just mentioned, I should say. So it wasn't a new modern facility. No. So staff from the visiting team was seated in a visiting team staff section of the press box. So we were in the middle of, you know, the media, and Art McNally, the then director of officiating, was behind me. And the reason I point that out is there's the no cheering in the press box rule, mm-hmm. which people try to abide by, but it doesn't always work.
Yeah.
So when we saw Woodson hit Brady, the ball come out, Beekert falling, we knew we couldn't scream. We knew we couldn't cheer. So my colleagues and I, the coworkers and I, we just started grabbing each other's arms and like expressing just incredible delight with our faces.
I can picture it. Yeah.
Squeezing one another because we didn't want to scream. And then I realized, oh my gosh, they're going to review this play. And as you know, the play was inside, just inside of 2 minutes. Had this play been only a couple of seconds sooner, game over.
Yeah.
Because New England had no timeouts. New England couldn't have challenged this. I'm getting myself all worked up.
Oh, I know.
I know. But I mean, when you think about football being referred to as a game of seconds and a game of inches, if this play happens only seconds earlier, game over. So anyway, it didn't. And it happened just seconds inside of 2 minutes. And I realized it was being reviewed. So I turned to Art McNally, who your listeners should know was not a young man at the time. He was very old. Oh, he was older. He was very esteemed. And I looked at him and in a very loud voice, because again, I have a loud voice. I wasn't trying to scream. I just talked loudly. I said, you better call 911 because if you overturn this play or this F, I'm trying not to swear.
I know. No, it's fine.
But you know, if you better call 911 because if you overturn this effing play, I'm going to have an effing stroke. But I didn't say effing. I said the word. Well, in that Mike Silver article I referred to earlier, it was reported by someone that I said, you better overturn, if you overturn this effing play, I'm going to have an effing heart attack. So I looked at my husband because I didn't recall I had said that. And I looked at my husband. I said, I didn't say that. I did not say that. I am contacting Sports Illustrated. I am demanding a retraction. My husband lets me go on and on for a bit. And then he looks at me and says, well, before you call Sports Illustrated, let me tell you what you really did say. You said, you better not overturn this effing play, because if you do, I'm going to have an effing stroke.
So it was,
yes. The whole effing part stayed the same. I can't even describe to you how just surreal it was.
Yeah.
And yes, we got the ball back. And yes, you know, everybody points out, Amy, you still had opportunities to win. And they're right. Except I saw the faces on our sidelines. I saw how incredulous and stunned everyone in the organization, coaches, players, all of us were. It was like someone had ripped into our heart, into our chest cavities and ripped our hearts out. Now, is that an excuse? No, we still had a chance to win the game. But in our minds, we had, and it was just taken from us. We were overwhelmed, just heartbroken.
No, and that's, and I can't imagine going from the highest of highs, we won the game, to what is happening and as it's playing out. And now everybody thinks it's over, and now you have to compose yourself and keep playing. It's an unbelievable unbelievable situation. And you are, what was great is that you, to this day, you are as adamant and as emotional as you were in 2001 to today, 2019, it's still with you. And that's that passion.
It is. And, you know, you stated it perfectly and far more articulately than I did, because I was getting myself all het up again. But yeah, we won the game. In our minds, the game was over. We won, game over, done. And now we had to regroup and play again. And that's why I'm very careful to say I don't offer that as an excuse, because other teams might have been able to regroup and win the game anyway. But I offer it as an explanation. We were just flabbergasted. And yes, I am as passionate about it today, but I will note this. Many people, when they hear me or see my tweets about it, Amy, get over it. Amy, let it go. And my response to that is, isn't this the fun of sports? There are so many things in life that we have to let go, that we have to say, all right, move on, let go. Well, the fun of sports is the passion that we have, and the fact that whether it's the immaculate reception or the tuck rule or any other play, you know, the catch, we all can continue to feel as passionate as we do. We don't have to let it go. That's the passion of sports.
And that's it. And that's what I think makes it so great. And I think that sometimes we don't want to see officiating controversies necessarily, but they're part of the lore of the game, right? It's part of the history and part of that romanticism of remembering, hey, if everything was just 100% accurate and there was no debate, no controversy, it would be boring. And sorry you had to be on the wrong end of that call. As the lore and the history, and we're celebrating 100 years of NFL football, but it is part of it. And
yeah, I was about to jump in and say, there's no beauty in that night. Now you and I, you know, let's have at it, Dean. There's no beauty in but I do understand what you're saying. It is part of what people remember about sport. It was just, oh, and then we couldn't get out of New England because it was snowing. And I will tell you this, we finally got home hours and hours and hours and hours delayed. And I got into my house and I was looking at email, and there was an email from my cousin, who's, you know, a very, very successful, smart lawyer. And he got a copy of the Tuck Rule, and he sent a mass email to everyone in the family, like 50 people, breaking down a legal analysis of the Tuck Rule. And I was so mad. I hit reply all, and I just wrote F, but I spelled the word out, F-U, and hit send. And my husband says to me a few minutes later, you know, you sent that to the entire family, including like your parents and everyone. And I didn't care. And maybe 20 minutes later, I get an email back to the whole family from my dad, and it said, Amy's right.
Well, I just want to say before I let you go that, you know, the Tuck Rule was changed in 2013. And who was the head of officiating that year? That was someone's first year. And one of his first orders of business was to change the Tuck Rule. Do you remember who that was?
Let me think. Rhymes with. Yeah, I can't think of a good rhyming word. I was going to be really cute and say what your name rhymed with. But I know who that was.
That was me. So that was an ode to you. And I thought it was perfectly... it was poetic that the Raiders abstained from that vote. That I thought that was amazing. I thought that was the punctuation point. That was it at the end.
And that was bringing back the old abstention of Raider lore, because that was one of my greatest and most proud moments, was when I got Al to let me end the process of abstaining and start voting on things. And it took a lot of work for me to get him to stop abstaining. But if ever there was a perfect moment for the organization to go back to abstaining, that was it.
It was it. I thought it was perfect poetic justice. So Amy, thank you so much. Amy, you can follow her on Twitter at Amy Trask. Maybe she'll say hi to you, which she does to a lot of us on Twitter. Amy, thank you so, so much for joining me.
Dean, may I say before we go that it really was a delight to join you on this. And it is so fun for me to watch how you are succeeding in media, and your every success is the league's loss.
Thank you so much, Amy.
All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, I'll share that league meeting story. And we're going to talk about a crazy play from college football's oldest and longest running rivalry next on Good Calls. All right, we're back on Good Calls. Thanks again to the Princess of Darkness, Amy Trask, for joining us.
Great.
A lot of great stories. She's still not over the tuck rule, by the way. Fox, they bring in guests on Sundays to hang out. And we have what's called the Avocado Room, which is Fox's cool, hip way of a green room, right? Because right. Avocado, we're in California, and blah, 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 whatever.
Avocado.
Exactly. So today... So today,
do it again, Chad.
Avocado toast. You guys going to get some avocado toast?
That's very Cali. So today, in addition to the normal guests, there was a group, John C. McGinley, the actor. Travis, give me a quick filmography on John C. McGinley.
I saw him walk into the room and I was like, I know this guy from somewhere. And the one that I knew right off the top of my head was Office Space and Scrubs.
Yeah, no, he's a good actor.
Yeah, but he's
actor.
Been in a ton of stuff.
Wait, who was he in Office Space? I do know that movie.
He was the boss, right? Who do you play in Office Space?
I don't even know.
Guy?
Yeah. He was in Scrubs. He was in Platoon.
Stop. You know about me in movies, man. Every single day we talk about this.
A ton of movies. So anyway...
And Dean gives a little speech to all the people that come through our cube and he tells them about what we do and how we're the real workers. And
yeah,
the
we work.
On the stage.
And then Terry and Howie and Strahan, they just yuck it up on camera for like 30 minutes and we're there all day working. So anyway, so John C. McGinley, who I've always appreciated as an actor, he's wearing a Giants hat. And I didn't realize he's from New York. He grew up in Manhattan.
I noticed that when I looked him up too. And, so he was one of the Bobs on Office Space. Anyways, keep
going. He was one of the Bobs. All right, so... So we're a Giants hat. So I grew up a Giants fan, grew up in New York, and we started talking. And then he went off on pass interference review. And he was like, I got a question. He's like, what's up with pass interference review? And it was interesting to hear, like, it's just funny because you think about this guy that is this Hollywood actor that they're just fans, right? He's right. Just like a football fan. And he was frustrated with how pass interference review was being administered, and we had this long conversation about it, and you know, the call in the Giants Patriots game and all of these things, and he, you know, and he was pretty like worked up about it. And I think so I'm hoping that John C. McGinley feels a little bit better about pass interference review, because like we talked about earlier, the standard does appear, at least when the call is not made on the field, that it has changed. So John C. McGinley, big football fan, great actor. Maybe hopefully we can reach out and get him on the show. And
that was a cool sighting
further. Yeah, it was. It definitely was.
You know, you could have gained a listener there. We talk about it on Good Calls every week, John.
Talk about it on Good
Calls. Yeah, I'm just not that kind of promoter. I'm not going to meet people and then, oh, you know what? I got a podcast.
Yeah, Shanks' assistant comes in there.
We're not doing that.
Playing his show.
So the other thing that happened to me this week, and you guys, we've talked about it on the podcast. I was doing the XFL. I'm helping out the XFL with their officiating, and I was doing a reading. We're doing these rules. We're going to do these things to help people understand the XFL rules because there's some changes. It's NFL rule based, but there's some differences. The kickoff is different. Overtime is different. So we wanted to do these things that we could post on social media and share with the fans, with diagrams, and they wanted me to voice them over. So I spent a couple of hours at a studio in Santa Monica doing voiceover work, which I never realized how hard it was. And you have a room full of people that are telling you, no, read it this way and read it with more of a smile and read it. And I'm like, I don't know what that means. But so the line I had to read about the kickoff, and the line was, don't worry, there'll still be plenty of action. There'll still be plenty of contact without the huge running start. So I don't want to give too much away about the XFL kickoff, but the line was huge running start. And if you listen to our show, you know that I'm from Long Island and I have a hard time pronouncing that word correctly. I can't pronounce the H. I just say huge. So it's spelled U-G-E. So I'm doing this line and the guy, he goes, Dean, it's great. We love it. It sounds great. Only one note to have. The huge is coming out as huge. Like it's just sounding like you're saying huge. And I'm like, no, it doesn't sound like that. I am saying huge. Like it's not. So he goes, well, okay, so let's just say it like you know, huge. And I literally couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. So I'm trying to say, and I, every time I say, I'm whispering because that's the only way I can pronounce the H. So I'm like, without the huge running start, and I did it, like literally did it seven times without the huge, huge, huge running start. So finally he goes, all right, so we're going to change huge to big. And can you do big running start? And I was like, yeah. And I felt like Rocky in Rocky II when he was doing, when he couldn't read the script. And I was like, hey, I'm not a dumb guy, you know. It was unbelievable. I literally, he got in my head. I couldn't say it.
We got to get a speech coach for you for that.
Huge running start.
If you want to keep that voiceover career going,
let's go to the brain of Blandino before we wrap it up.
All right, here we go. Ready? My little. I'm looking. Oh, this is a good one. Pineapple on pizza / barbecue chicken.
Well, this goes to the whole, okay, this goes to the whole conversation of, you know, pizza and pineapple on pizza.
You're certainly a purist.
I'm a traditionalist purist. I'm not a pizza snob, and you guys know that.
This is true.
I'm from New York, but I will eat pizza from anywhere.
One of very few New Yorkers I've met.
I never sit there and I go, oh, it's not New York pizza. Da, 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 da. I'm not, you know, so, but I know, I guarantee you, I know more about pizza than Barstool Presidente over there.
Whoa.
I guarantee you. Okay. But anyway, so the thing is.
Is that a challenge? Is that a pizza off challenge?
Whatever. We can do it.
You know what we should do? We should get like one of those people who. What are they like?
A hype man?
Like sommeliers, but for like taste buds.
Oh, yeah.
And they could give like a real rating on the pizza, and then we'll see
you
who
know
thinks.
Who's legit? The legit pizza guy, he had a show on Vice, the pizza guy. He's from Brooklyn, I think, and he has his own, but I think if you can look him up, Travis, he's great. That guy, I've watched him on Vice. They had the pizza show.
Well, according to Scott in the Cube, if this gets back to Barstool, you're going to get your door kicked.
In. And I love those guys. I went on Part of My Take. I love those guys. I just, you know, I am a pizza connoisseur, but I'm not a pizza snob. And so here's the thing. Pineapple, I'm very torn with the whole pineapple barbecue chicken, like barbecue sauce on pizza, pineapple on pizza. I don't see it. I don't think it tastes good. I don't like, but apparently a lot of people like it.
Okay, so where are you at, Travis?
I actually like pineapple on pizza.
I can't stand pineapple on pizza.
I think it's great. You get a little sweet with the savory. It's awesome.
It's just, it's not the flavor profile. It's the heat. Hot pineapple. Like, would you throw a pineapple in the oven and just eat it? That's gross.
So I'll make stir fry and I'll throw some pineapple in there. It's good.
I just always get pineapple like a nice cold. It's like refreshing. A refreshing pina colada.
I get off the boat. It's hot day. Give me some pineapple. I'm in.
You're going to rule against me on this one?
I probably have softened my stance on this, but I'm not a big.
I'm getting to you.
I'm not a big pineapple.
So to me, the pineapple is a. But I dig a barbecue chicken pizza. I ain't gonna lie.
So Dan Jensen's your guy from Vice.
No. His name's not Dan Jensen.
Oh, my bad then.
The pizza show. Google the pizza show on Vice.
Too late.
Got a couple of guys here saying Dan Jensen. My bad.
Is it? No, I don't think it is. Dan Jensen wasn't Dan Jensen like the guy, the decathlete?
Dan Jensen.
So give us the top three California pizzas real quick.
California pizzas that I've been to?
Yes.
I'll tell you what. There's Joe's in Santa Monica that is very New York style that I like. And I'm not opposed to other styles of pizza. That's what I grew up with. And Joe's in Santa Monica is the closest in this area that I've seen. You know, buy the slice. You can go in. You get a couple slices. It has that pizzeria, pizza parlor feel. Honestly, Fresh Brothers is not bad for what it is.
I love Fresh Brothers.
Fresh Brothers. My kids love Fresh Brothers. Fresh Brothers for the kind of the delivery, you know, the Domino's Pizza Hut style. Fresh Brothers is
I think for
good.
The chain, Fresh Brothers for is chain, far and away the best.
Fresh Brothers is,
and the deep
is
dish
really good. Yeah, the deep
legit.
Dish is great. I'll tell you.
And they've got a keto crust now too for us that are watching.
I'll tell you the pizza that I really like is Tower 12 in Hermosa Beach. Tower 12 does a Parmesan
ricotta stuff.
Yeah, but it's got Parmesan like on it. It's a pizza, but the crust has ricotta cheese and Parmesan. It's just really, really good. Tower 12. I'll tell you what's not good pizza is also in Hermosa Beach, but I'm not going to throw anybody down under the bus.
Yeah, I know those guys. So
yeah, I'm not going to throw anybody under the bus. I'm just saying Hermosa Beach, every pizzeria in Hermosa Beach isn't that great. Okay. What's the guy? What's his name?
Frank Pineo?
Yeah, that's
okay.
Him. That's
yeah,
him.
The other guy, Dan Jensen, Vice did a story on him. He's only eaten pizza for the last 25 years.
He's going to die.
Oh, so. we're going to talk about him next week. All right. Well, that's our show. Thanks for listening.
1884 was the matchup. That's when it started with Lehigh.
This has been Good Calls with Dean Blandino. Please follow me on Twitter at Dean Blandino, on Instagram at Dean.Blandino. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at Rules Podcast. And be sure to rate our podcast on the iHeartRadio app and on Apple Podcasts. Good Calls with Dean Blandino is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.